again?
No.
So, two announcements before we start. First, just to remind you that tomorrow at 6 o'clock, Ressa Lang, which is on 13th Street, on the uptown side of the street, Gustavus talking on motherhood today, which sounds like an intriguing topic. And then something I didn't know about, but I don't even know what association this is, but this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, at the Fordham University Manhattan campus, there is really a fabulous Sarsha conference that has just about anyone, Sonia Crook, Penny Deutscher, Ronald Aronson, Dennis Collier. I mean, really a fantastic lineup of speakers. If you want to see the program, have a look at halftime. That's the whole program. But I really urge you, I mean, this is really, looks like a really major event. So tomorrow, Thursday.
Can we check it in here? Sorry.
I'm sure it's here somewhere. Maybe. The dialectic keeps moving. There's the announcement for the Kristeva. Okay, any mechanical questions? Everyone? Okay, you gave me a very, very, very bad week. I felt that if something was going wrong, then I was doing something wrong. So I paid dearly and wrote a whole new lecture on force and understanding, which is now you have to suffer. So everyone, we all suffered together. But I assume that if something goes wrong, it's because, this is something to think about in teaching, when the class goes wrong, it's usually because there's an enthymeme somewhere, which is to say there's an argument with missing steps. And what I've tried to do is find out what the missing steps were and put them in. So what I'm trying to do today is get there in a way that is compelling and do all the things that various people ask me to do after the class and say, oh, we'll do this, do that. So I thought I would. And I want to reframe the question of force and understanding. And I hope this week you'll be ready to ask me questions if I go astray. But I want to reframe it from a hint that Adam Gies gave me last time in class. So, let me catch my breath. Two steps to really keep as our frame. And here's the first two steps of the frame. First, that my reading of Hegel's phenomenological method, in which we can phenomenologically look on. We can look on because consciousness examines itself. And consciousness examines itself because every form of consciousness poses its own conception of truth, what Hegel calls the in itself, and a corresponding conception of knowing. We're cognizing that kind of in itself must be like. In itself, this, the form of knowing, sense certainty. And I suggested that this method, this way in which there's an internal relationship between an in itself and a for consciousness, truth, certainty, is in fact nothing but a generalization of Kant's Copernican term, in which self-consciousness relates to objects by projecting upon the world a concept of an object in general. So my operating assumption all along is that we Kantians have that idea. That is, we face the world by projecting upon it some concept of an object in general, and the phenomenological method simply assumes that for every possible form of consciousness. Second framing thought. The entire chapter on consciousness, that is, sense certainty, perception, and force and understanding, those three forms of consciousness, all of which are called consciousness by Hegel, what makes them all consciousness is that they are pre-Kantian and hence pre-Copernican in their assumptions about how they relate to the world. That is, each of those three forms assume there is an in itself, the this, the object of perception, the one in the many, and force, that is the ultimate matter of fact which makes knowledge true. Now, to say that these are pre-Kantian or pre-Copernican makes it sound as if they're making a dumb mistake, but they're not. So I want to step one step back and say what's important about these forms of consciousness. What they're assuming is, in fact, deeply intuitive. Namely, what they're assuming is that the fundamental structure of knowing involves us in matching our representations to the world. So the world is the measure of our knowing. And hence the world is the measure of truth. As oppositely now, so knowing world, and in the knowing world relationship, world determines knowing. So the direction is from the world to knowing. As oppositely, we suppose, and this is why it's deep, in action, we assume that we determine or make the world. That is, we make the world correspond to our desires or needs or plans or ends or goals. And that this structure, that the direction of knowing runs from world to mind, while the direction of action runs from mind to world, is the difference between knowing and acting. That in knowing we're trying to get our representations to correspond to the world, while in action we're trying to get the world to correspond to our actions. Right? Which is why, you know, Marx got so upset with Feuerbach. Right? So the overwhelming assumption is how knowing differs from action is in their fundamental direction. That the direction of knowing is that the world determines me, hence that there must be a deep stratum of passivity in the phenomenon of knowing in order for objectivity to be possible. While conversely, the direction of action is that I determine the world, hence a fundamental stance of activity. So that knowing and action are different stances towards the world. As if, right, In knowing, we contemplate the world. That's why it's often thought of contemplation. In action, we make the world. So, now looking at this structure, it may look familiar to you, since, in fact, we often think that this way of this passivity is what gives us the idea that the world determines mind causally, while action determines the world through freedom. And if we look at that structure, it suddenly begins to look like Kant's third antinomy, where every cause has another cause. No cause without a first cause. I'll come back to this structure in a moment. But the thought here is that consciousness is playing out this stance. Consciousness is assuming this structure, which is just the intuitive, traditional, classical structure about the difference between knowing and action. And it makes just one, or rather, two further assumptions. First, that I am in the world, and hence I have a world only through my representations of the world. So that's representation that gives me a world in general. And second, that the fundamental meaning of knowing is that the world determines me, and hence I am passive with respect to the world. Force and understanding in this setup is hence the scientific picture of this structure, and hence the idea that the meaning of consciousness is being given by a certain kind of representation of the world, namely the kind of representation of the world that is assumed above all in modern natural science, but also, for reasons I'll come to in a moment, in Plato. Plato and modern natural science share many similar structures. Okay, those are the two background assumptions governing this setup. An aside. As we're going to see later, the structural view that knowledge in the last instance requires a stance of passivity and action in the last stance requires one of absolute activity, that structure, or world determining me, me determining world, exactly as is the structure of Kant's third antinomy on causality and freedom, and is equally the structure of the first two chapters of the phenomenology. This is the structure of consciousness as a whole, and this is going to be the structure of self-consciousness as a whole, action-determining world. That's where we're going. Now, both views are false. You knew that was coming. And unlike Kant, Kant, what Kant does is says, both true views must be true. And in order to make both views true, he draws a line between them and calls this phenomena and this noumena. And that's how Kant solves or preserves the ultimate structure of this way of doing things. Hegel is not going to resolve this antinomy by adopting a notion of noumenal freedom. He is going to argue that consciousness cannot sustain its posture of passivity. That's what we're going to read about today. Why consciousness is forced into become the stance of agency. But we're equally going to discover that self-consciousness is going to have to acknowledge absolute dependency or passivity. So, complicated story here, but roughly we're going to join these, and their joining is going to be reason. So we're going to get a different resolution to this fundamental deep structure, and I'm saying this deep structure is very much the structure of what knowledge means. And if you read analytic philosophy, they assume this structure all the time. This is what analytic philosophy is about, this structure and how the two sides hang together, and it's all variations on the Kantian solution. Or even worse, just subsuming this side into that side. Just make it all passive, right? Make a passivity all the way down. But, you know, even Sellers, for those of you who know Sellers, you know, this, you know, becomes the manifest image, and this becomes the scientific image. It just becomes incoherent at that very point. Right? And Sellers kind of knew it. He has a thing called Meditations Hegelian, where he tries to worry about this problem. Okay. That's the end of my aside. That's the structural setup. Here's the third moment, what Adam reminded me I needed to say. The third element of my frame. Hegel supposes that despite the fact that all of consciousness is pre-Copernican, and despite the fact that our method itself is Copernican, that what Hegel is trying to do in the chapter on consciousness is phenomenologically demonstrate the necessity of the Copernican term. That he wants to demonstrate how consciousness cannot sustain its fundamentally passive stance, and it cannot continue to deny its own constitutive role in making objectivity possible, and that it is somehow, and here's the problem that you were all suffering with last week, it is somehow forced, made, pushed to turn upon itself and to take responsibility for its knowing. Now, I put it that way, it's forced to take responsibility for its knowing. I am not saying it's forced to become active, because consciousness has been active almost from the beginning. But it explicitly becomes active already in consciousness, right? It becomes active when it says, I'm responsible for falsity. But it just tries to make that activity non-constitutive of the conditions of objectivity. So the shift is going to be it must acknowledge the constitutive role of its activity. That is, its responsibility, and I'll get to this in a moment, for articulating the relationship between identity and difference, the one and the many. Okay, so this is the kicker. We must demonstrate the necessity of the Copernican turn, and it's interesting that Hegel takes this as his job, because it's exactly what Kant did not do and thought could not be done. On the contrary, if you recall, Kant introduced the Copernican turn as already happening, as, to put it in his terms, a conjecture or hypothesis. So he doesn't demonstrate that we have to turn. What he asks is, I'm now quoting from B16 in the introduction, we must therefore make trial. We must therefore attempt, make trial, whether we may not have more success in the tasks of metaphysics if we suppose that our objects must conform to our knowledge. That they must conform to us, not we conform to them. This is an extraordinary thing to say. That the Copernican turn is asking, rather demanding, that knowledge, the world, conform to it. Now, of course, I can see you're already thinking, Kant's looking weirder by the second. Of course, only at the level of form, not the level of content. The form is the concept of an object in general, or the worldhood of the world. That's where we project the contents, the actual empirical contents, come from the world. Nonetheless, that's the thesis. So he says a page earlier in the introduction, when he's actually talking about how he's reading modern science, they learn that reason has insight only into what it produces after a plan of its own. Reason has insight only what it produces after a plan of its own. And that must not allow itself to be kept, as it were, in nature's leading strings. That is actually going to be the conclusion of force and understanding. We get insight only after a plan of our own. Okay, that's the frame. So we have to demonstrate the necessity of making the Copernican turn. But of course, it's slightly question-begging, again, because it's a Copernican methodology that's going to lead us there. Now the puzzle. Are we all right there? Let me just take a breath. That's the setup. Are we all clear about it? Get exhausted thinking about the setup. A reasonable frame of problematicity. Now the question arises. I think this is where I screwed up last week. Probably wondering, where did he screw up? Here's where I screwed up. What kind of failure is occurring in force and understanding? What kind of defeat does this form of consciousness undergo? And why, just to push this thought a bit further, why does this form of failing force it into Copernicanism? That's, I think, the micro grain of argumentation that I have not yet got fully perspicuous, but I'm going to try to make it perspicuous now. Or at least it looks perspicuous to me at 3 o'clock this morning when I wrote this. Okay. In sense certainty, the failure occurred, just to remind you, the nature of the failure occurred, because consciousness could not achieve the determinacy that its own stipulation, its notion of the in itself, required. So it kept wanting to say this, and it kept, this never appeared. So the indeterminate, the determinate, pointing always became indeterminate and indeed the universal. The form of failure in perception is different. And this is kind of interesting all by itself, and we ought to be thinking about how different forms of consciousness fail, and they're going to fail differently. The form of failure in perception occurred not because of lack of determinacy. The determinacy was given by the complex of universals. That's how objects are determinate. It failed because it could not hold together the two components of its concept of an object. The one and the many. That is, it couldn't figure out how the determinacy from the many was the many of a one. Right? So what it couldn't think, sometimes I love philosophy for it, it's atrocious silliness. What it couldn't think is the word of. Why are these properties of the thing? Right? It couldn't hold that together, and it kept falling apart. Now, the most important thing to notice about the one in the chapter on perception is that it is a bare substratum. That is, it was not itself actually a perceptual item, but rather it was a kind of posit or presupposition necessary to hold the many properties together. Why is that important? Well, it's because Hegel's being sneaky. And what he's doing is little by little phenomenologically introducing the idea that in order to have a determinate cognitive awareness of an object or event, there must be some feature of that object or situation, namely its oneness, what makes it a determinate one, that is not itself perceptual or sensible. Right? So just think about you or Locke. What they've got lots of stuff going on, right? What they can't do is figure out the notion of one. And they can't figure out the notion of one because the notion of one itself is not another perceptual item. Which, of course, is what Hume kept saying. There's no idea of substance. There's no idea of the underlying. There's nothing, you know. But the opposite thought should be ticking away. It's going to be Kant's thought. That, indeed, the one is not another perceptual item. and that therefore the necessary condition for the possibility of object awareness is that there be a non-sensible one collecting or holding together the sensible many. In the handout I gave you from Kant, we'll come back to this, there's any place in Kant where he actually makes the Copernican turn. Yeah. You have to do what Rossio says to do. If there's any place in the first critique where Kant actually does a Copernican turn, as I will come to later, is actually A109. A109 is one of my favorite passages. I wrote half my PhD on it. So those who've done Kant with me already will be bored by the way I keep coming back to this passage. Just the very beginning of A109 is all I want to look at. Appearances are the sole objects which can be given to us immediately. You there? And that in them which relates immediately to an object is called intuition. But these appearances are not things in themselves. They are only representations, which in turn have their object, an object which cannot itself be intuited by us, and which may therefore be named the non-empirical, that is, the transcendental object equals X. Now, what he's thinking about in the transcendental object equals X is Locke's new way of ideas. And Locke's idea is that we have these somethings, these properties, and there must be something underlying them, which is a something I know not what. That's why it's an X. Because it's not another perceptual item. It's a something I know not what, and it's the source of the unity. Now, consciousness in force and understanding is searching for that transcendental object. It is looking for the X, which will confer upon the appearances a unity. And it is positing that, and it is doing so in order that it can satisfy the dilemma raised by perception, which had the one and the many falling apart. So what force and understanding is going to do is say there must really be an underlying something. And therefore there must be a two-tiered account of the concept and object in general, in which the unity of the object is derived from a non-sensible ground, or what Hegel calls an unconditioned universal. So the whole movement of the chapter on force and understanding is an exploration of the various non-ideal candidates for the non-sensible unity of experience. Now you're getting it. I saw a smile. I haven't seen a smile in weeks. Okay. So each of the things that are going to go be put on, forces and laws and all this kind of stuff, all that is going to be the transcendental object equals x. It's going to be placeholders for the x. It's going to be values of that variable. So making Locke's account truly metaphysically two-tiered, as I won't go through the story, it really wasn't Locke. And this Locke was not an empiricist, but a scientific realist. That's another whole course. Okay. Well, now, what I said last week may make a little sense. My first gambit last week, and I'm not going to repeat what I did last week. I'm going to mention it now and then move forward. So you'll just have to stick in the, because I didn't look back either. Stick in the missing bits. But my first argument last week concerned, in moving to the two-tiered model, we posit the notion of force as the underlying source of unity. And we chose force, if you recall, because force, by its very nature, is something that must express itself. That is, the in itself of force, what force is to be for another. That is, to create the appearances. Now, my argument last week was that this move did not really take us past the dilemma that we already saw in the chapter on perception. Let us think of it this way. Now I'm going to do a variation on this, tying it into contemporary views in the philosophy of science. If we ask ourselves, what makes a particular underlying force the force it is, the answer is going to be that it gives rise to exactly these appearances. So that the meaning of the force, which was supposed to be the explainer, is given by what it explained. Okay? And there's, of course, there's a whole literature on this. Start with it, you know, the simplest version is in Molière, if I recall correctly, where someone says, you know, opium has a secret normative power. Oh, what is that power that opium has? It makes you fall asleep. Well, the question is, what more do we learn about the meaning of power than we fall asleep when we take opium? That is the upshot of the claim that something has a certain power is simply the appearances it gives at the end of the day. So, and now this is, by the way, the standard empiricist instrumentalist critique of scientific realism and theories of power and force, namely that there's no more content in force or power talk than the regularity of the appearances that it was meant to explain. That is, it's sort of empty. We already know, take some opium, you fall asleep. All right, now we have a causal regularity. Take some opium, fall asleep. Okay. Now the scientific realist says, I know why. Because it has the power. And now you ask, well, what is that power? It makes you fall asleep. So, we can't seem to get any extra content out of the postulation of forces or powers or intellectes or whatever other stuff you think is going on there. And even in contemporary philosophy of science, this is a standard critical gesture. The most sustained version of it you can find in Bob Van Frossen's writings. But there are versions of it, you know, a writer I really admire, namely Nancy Cartwright, in a wonderful book called Why Do the Laws of Nature Lie? Which is a bit more complicated than that argument. But nonetheless, there is a kind of assumption that ultimately the postulation of these things, the cash value, are the regularities themselves. So think of that as the standard realist, I'm sorry, the standard empiricist, instrumentalist critique of scientific realism. Flip side now, in contrast to this, the empiricist is going to argue that since the content of these theories just is the appearances themselves, then scientific theories and laws are really simply best understood as forms of inductive summations of those appearances. That is, accounts of, so causal laws are really about regularities in the appearances. And we have these laws because they enable us to make predictions and the like. So, to know that B regularly follows A, so falling asleep regularly follows taking opium, or whatever you do with opium. Well, what's that called? Taking it. Shows my naivete. I'm just guessing. So, to know that B, falling asleep regularly follows A, taking the opium, is to know why B occurred. Namely, because A, that is, I fell asleep because I took opium. Now, if you have an iota of curiosity as a human being, this is terribly unsatisfying, since this merely re-describes what happened without really providing an answer to why. Which is why scientists really are interested in mechanisms. Nonetheless, so if you really want to know why, then you're going to start using power and force and mechanisms all over again. So we can see that, and this is the structure of an ongoing debate between empiricists and rationalists. That is, one of them suggesting that we need to posit a second tier, and the other arguing that the second tier is nothing but a rather metaphysical way of stating what is already there in the appearances. Now, of course, here in Hegel, we're not actually debating the status of scientific theories. Hegel's arguments nonetheless exactly mimic this debate. But what Hegel's concerned with is the philosophical and metaphysical corollary which presumes that these theories just are connectedness to the world. That is, they represent how we have a world at all, by having a model of the world that represents the world like that. And remember last week I said we are committed to this because it's already implied by perception itself. We have to go into the two-tier scientific view. Now, in the dialectic of this chapter, when faced with the emptiness of inductive empiricism, we are offered increasingly complicated accounts of the underlying forces. Forces, so now going on to Hegel's next stage, soliciting and being solicited by one another. And what I want to say here, and this is the point, that apart from details, the arguments here are going to be every single one of them. Why is that door? Party going on up there. That the arguments here are going to be just a repetition of what we already seen. Namely, that the upshot of all these forces is simply going to be the appearances, again, so paragraph 141, what they are, what these forces are, they are only in this middle term, in this contact, the contact that happens at the level of appearances. And in the same paragraph 141, towards the end, Hegel begins hinting at where he is going. Thus, the truth of force, he says, remains only in the thought. Of course, the only is going to become the truth. That is, the thought of it is going to be the real thing and not merely an hypothesis. Now, all of this presses understanding into more desperate attempts to generate a nonsensible but non-ideal condition that can plausibly ground the appearances, collect them up, unify them, without skeptical remainder. So that's the project. Every step in this chapter is searching for a non-sensible but non-ideal, non-mentalistic condition of possibility to unify the appearances, and that can be plausibly what is underlying them. However, the important extra gesture that happens at this juncture is that the understanding now recognizes that the non-sensible condition must be really, Hegel's word is, supersensuous. So in saying that it's simply not non-sensible, not immediately there, but it must be supersensuous, that is, it must be the kind of nonsensical condition that is, I want to say, thought-like. Almost an ideal. So a supersensible world that is actually metaphysically there. Which is why I can see you're puzzled as hell. For heaven's sakes, think Plato, first of all. And then think Galileo, second of all. That will do it. And then think Newton, third of all. Okay, get the picture. So, which is why Hegel now shifts his account to a discussion from forces to a discussion of law. But law not conceived of things we make, but law as already the structure of the universe. So law read Platonistically. Law as the metaphysical truth lying behind or regulating the appearances. So, you know, if you go to MIT and you go into the bathroom, MIT has weird graffiti on the walls, you know, and, you know, the one I saw was, God said, And then, you know, an endless equation covering the whole stall. And then he said that, and there was light. But that's the thought here. That's the structure of the world. Einstein thought this in his letters to Born. He says, God, you know, thought in mathematics. Mathematics is the true underlying structure of the world. Law is that. So law is not something we posit. It is a metaphysical reality, is the thought. Okay? So law is the quiet, unchanging structure. Law does not change, but law is the law of everything that does change. So law is the unity, the unchanging, underlying something of everything that does change. Now, notice again that consciousness is now taking the non-sensible ground, again, to be kind of like itself, kind of thought-like. And again, Hegel's first go at this new thinking of the non-sensible ground, namely that we just postulate it, there must be this non-sensible ground, and we assume that we can have... How on earth did Plato see the ideas, right? He had some sort of weird intellectual intuition, right? And Hegel imagines here that someone imagines they can have this weird kind of intellectual intuition and simply see these ideas as the truth of the universe. So they can see or directly perceive this supersensible beyond. So at the very beginning of paragraph 146, again, I always feel I ought to every once in a while touch the text so you know I'm not making it up. The inner world, that's what this is, the inner world, is for consciousness still a pure beyond because consciousness does not yet find itself in it. That's the kind of self-repudiation at work here. It is empty, for it is merely the nothingness of appearance and positively the simple or unitary universal. The mode of the inner being of things finds ready acceptance by those who say that the inner of things is unknowable. Now, at the beginning of paragraph 147, just to show you the dialectic, he says, the inner world, or supersensible beyond, what we've just been discussing, has, however, come into being. It comes from the world of appearances, which has mediated it. In other words, the appearances is its essence, in fact, its filling. So, paragraph 146 is the rationalist two-tiered model. Paragraph 147, the instrumentalist reductive critique. That the real content of the inner is simply the outer and what appears. So just the same structure all over again. Hence, we are brought back to the appearances determining or giving determinacy to what is supposed to be their ground. And so the dialectic here remains the same. For the sake of explanatory content, we posit some extra empirical item to provide the world with a true metaphysical two-tiered structure, whose second tier is found to require appearances in order to explain its determinacy, so the explainer is explained by what it explains. Hence, the explainer is turned into the explained. Hence, the relation between the two is an inversion. That, in fact, as we're going to see in a moment, everything we've been seeing is about a series of inversions. The sensuous becoming the supersensuous, the supersensuous becoming the truth of the supersensuous, becoming the sensuous. So the whole chapter is this series of inversions. Okay, let me say something about law. No, let me stop there, because we're about to get on to the inverted world. You knew it was coming, but I thought, before we talk about the inverted world, a cup of coffee is necessary. So let's take a deep breath, have our usual break, and we'll talk about law and then the inverted world. And if you now got questions, come back full of them.